Will Rogers, Ambassador of Goodwill, Prince of Wit and Wisdom, by P.J. O'Brien, with an appreciation by Lowell Thomas. Will Rogers, the character and the temperament of an age as well as its common sense are reflected in its laughter. So says Dr. J.C. Gregory in his treatise on the sense of humor. He remarks further, "The way men laugh and the things they laugh at reflect their tastes, thoughts, and sympathies. Society offers its pulse in the nature of its laughter." The career of Will Rogers is the finest illustration you could find of those observations. If we hadn't had him during the last 10 years, if we hadn't appreciated him and had the sense to laugh with him or at ourselves, we should have been a sad people. He first burgeoned out as the smiling prophet of America in the era of the Great Insanity, the period we remember because of the tragic comedy of the Teapot Dome, which culminated in the cataclysm of November 1929. Politico Magnifico's worried and denounced. Editors exploded in 12-point type. Rogers poured out a steady stream of sparkling common sense that helped us maintain some sort of perspective. When the Depression descended upon us in such volume that not even the most ostrich-minded could deny it, the man from Oklahoma stuck out among us as a flashy tower of sanity, and people listened to him. Historians and economists tried to remind us that there had been previous depressions and that the Republic had survived, but we needed the droll, jovial gags of Will Rogers to make us keep our feet on the ground. One of the finest facts about him was that he never took a crack at any man, either a man, a party, or a class, unless he or it was riding cockily on top of the world. For example, his most ludicrous comment upon bankers was delivered at a time when they were the sacred white cows of every editorial office in America. It was in 1924 that Rogers came out with the paragraph, "Vanderlip made a speech at the Rotary Club of Sing Sing, New York, that astonished the United States. Rotaries comprised of one of the best of each line of work or business. Mr. Vanderlip must have felt right at home up there. There are more bankers at Sing Sing than any other town of its size in the United States." If that had been said in 1933, it would have been an obvious, almost cowardly jab. But at the time that Rogers published it, bankers were still the high priests of finance, quoted with reverence upon any subject, from world politics to birth control. After the pendulum had swung, after they had become a general target for abuse, Rogers declined to join the chorus. Instead, he turned the fire of his comedic machine guns upon the people who were kicking the bankers. As he himself said, with his unforgettable grin, "I'm always agin the party that's up." At the height of the Teapot Dome scandal, he kidded Senator Walsh, the prosecutor, as merrily as he did Sinclair and Donaghy. Later on, when the bankers were in the pillory, Rogers aimed his most pointed barbs at their inquisitors, Senator Black and Counselor Ferdy Pecora. On all such occasions, the essence of his quality was that he made everybody like it. Some of us winced a bit, but after we had caught our breath, we all had to join in the laughter. Since his death, the pundits have been saying that Rogers had not as deep a background of philosophy as Mark Twain. How Will would have chuckled at the suggestion. But if you consider his jesting as a whole, you will see that the gum-chewing master of the lariat had one of the soundest and oldest of all philosophies in the world, a fine scorn for all shams and pretensions. It was always the bumptious, the posers, at whom he poked the most fun. He had an amazing faculty for penetrating poses, equaled only by his ability to do it without venom. One of the principal differences between him and Mark Twain was that Rogers lacked capacity for the fierce indignation to which Clemens gave vent in his later years. In describing Innocents Abroad, Stephen Leacock had aptly observed that Mark Twain could see Europe more clearly from the top of the Rockies than could the people walking in the Rue de Rivoli or sitting around the Forum in Rome. Rogers had a good measure of the same faculty. He could see not only Europe, but his own country, but it never made him indignant. the only pose in Will Rogers was the pretense that he was an ignorant and illiterate fellow. Actually, he was nothing of the sort. As he once remarked, we are all of us ignorant, but not about the same things. Though he made a bluff at concealing it, his writings from time to time betrayed an exceedingly wide knowledge. Whether he was conscious of it or not, the system behind his humor was an exceedingly old one. It can be described in one word, truth. It is one of the most ancient formula of the comic spirit. As Max Eastman has remarked, truth is a chief source of the joy motive in popular jokes. We are always hungry for the simple truth. That, in the last analysis, is what Will Rogers gave us. Signed, Lowell Thomas. Chapter 1. The Tragedy of the Tundra. In the weird half-light of a summer night in the far north, a red, low-winged monoplane skimmed gracefully along the surface of the shallow river that pierced the bleak Alaskan tundra. The ship gained speed, climbed a scanty 50 feet, and then plunged awkwardly, out of control, to the water below. It was as if some invisible hunter with a powerful, silent weapon had sent a lethal charge into the gaily colored, man-made bird. No one moved in the broken plane. Its occupants had made their final landing. Thus did Will Rogers, beloved prince of wit and wisdom, and Wiley Post, master aviator, meet their end in the barren wilderness a few miles from the last outpost of civilization in North America. Only a terrified Eskimo seal hunter saw the ship as it crashed into the edge of the little unnamed stream, and in his fright, he ran away from the tangled wreckage of the once roaring machine of his white-faced brothers. As the echo of the crash rolled away over the Hamakati tundra, the native Claire Okpia made his way back to the riverbank and shouted loudly to the men in the plane. There was no answer, only the Arctic stillness. Realizing that the occupants of the plane were beyond his aid, Okpia set out to bring the news of the disaster to Point Barrow, 15 miles away, northernmost point on the continent where the United States Army Signal Corps maintains a radio station. Over the dry hammocks, through the little streams wending their way into the Arctic Ocean and around tiny lakes, where nested the white whistling swans and the black-necked geese, the Eskimo walked and raced until 3 hours later he reached the settlement. Exhausted, he stopped near the radio shack to gasp out to a group of natives, "Birdmen dead! Red bird blow up!" Staff Sergeant Stanley R. Morgan of the Signal Corps, the only representative of the government north of Latitude 71, heard the native story, and from his pidgin English, the soldier knew that the plane was that of Post and that the passenger was Will Rogers. Out into the Arctic night went Sergeant Morgan to round up a crew of Eskimo seal hunters to go to the scene. In a whaleboat kicked along by an outboard motor, they churned their way southward through the little streams and across the tiny ponds. It was several hours later before they came upon the wreckage. The plane lay on its back in 2 feet of water. Its right wing was crumpled, its engine jammed back into the cockpit. His daughter's picture. In Roger's pocket was his Ingersoll watch, still ticking, showing the time at 3:30 a.m. On Post watch was a smashed watch showing the time 8:18 p.m., the time of the crash on August 15, 1935. Both bodies were wrapped in blankets and placed in an omiak, an Eskimo open boat made of skin stretched over a frame. From Roger's coat fell a newspaper clipping bearing the picture of his 18-year-old daughter Mary, who at the time was playing with a summer theater group in Maine in a play entitled Ceiling Zero. By a strange coincidence, the drama has for its climax a fatal airplane crash. The crash. Back at Point Barrow, Sergeant Morgan dashed to his radio key to tell the world of the tragedy. His report, as wirelessed to the War Department at Washington, gave a graphic description of the crash as obtained from Okpia. It read, "At 10 p.m. last night, attracted by a group of excited natives on the beach, walking down discovered one native all out of breath, gasping in pidgin English a strange tale of airplane she blow up. After repeated questioning, learned this native witnessed crash of an airplane at his sealing camp some 15 miles south of Barrow and had run the entire distance to summon aid. Native claimed plane flying very low suddenly appeared from the south and apparently sighted tent. Plane then circled several times and finally settled upon small river near camp. Two men climbed out, one wearing rag on sore eye and the other big man with boots. The big man then called native to the water's edge and asked distance and direction to Point Barrow. Direction given, men then climbed back into the plane and taxied off to far side of river for takeoff into wind. After short run, plane slowly lifted from water to height about 50 feet, banking slightly to the right, when evidently motor stalled. Plane slipped off on right wing and nosed down into water, turning completely over. Native claimed dull explosion occurred, and most of right wing dropped off, and a film of gasoline and oil soon covered the water. Native, frightened by explosion, turned and ran, but soon controlled fright and returned, calling loudly to men in plane. Receiving no answer, then made decision to come to Barrow for help. With completion of the story, we knew plane to be that of Post and Rogers and quickly assembled a crew of 14 Eskimos and departed in an open whaleboat powered with small gas motor. Hampered by recent ice flows and strong adverse current, took nearly 3 hours to reach destination. Dense fog with semi-darkness gave upturned plane most ghostly appearance, and our hearts chilled at the thought of what we might find there. As we approached nearer the plane, we realized that no human could possibly survive the terrific crash. The plane was but a huge mass of twisted and broken wood and metal. The natives by this time had managed to cut into the cabin and extricate the body of Rogers, who apparently had been well back in the cabin when the plane struck and was more or less protected by the baggage carried therein. We soon learned we would have a difficult time freeing Post from the wreckage, as the plane had struck with such terrific speed it had forced the engine well back into the cabin, pinning the body of Post securely. With some difficulty, we managed to tear the plane apart and eventually released the body of Post. Both bodies were then carefully laid and wrapped with eiderdown sleeping bags found in the wreckage and then carefully placed in the boat. It is believed the natives felt the loss of these two great men as keenly as we. As we started back to Barrow, one of the Eskimo boys began to sing a hymn in Eskimo, and soon all voices whined in the singing and continued it until our arrival at Barrow, where we silently bore the bodies from the beach to the hospital, where they were turned over to Dr. Henry Christ, who, with the kindly help of Charles D. Brower, prepared and dressed the bodies. It is doubtful if a person in this little village slept that night. All sat around the hospital with bowed heads, with little or no talking. King Charlie of the Arctic. Dr. Christ, mentioned in the report, abandoned his Indiana medical practice in 1920 to go as a Presbyterian medical missionary to Alaska. Rogers and Post were on their way to visit Brower, known as King Charlie to the Eskimos, who had lived under the flaming lights of the Aurora Borealis for 51 years. He left his home in New York at the age of 21 to go to the Arctic. It was only a trifling 10-minute hop from the scene of the crash to Point Barrow, but it was sufficient to bring a violent end to what had started as an aerial vacation that would have taken them leisurely around the world by way of Alaska, Siberia, China, Russia, and possibly Ethiopia. Rogers joined Post in Seattle, and 2 days later, they took off for Juneau. Post was well known in Alaska because of two flights around the world, but it was the first visit of Rogers to the country, and everywhere crowds gathered to cheer him and shake his hand. Before taking off from Seattle, Mrs. Post, according to Rogers, asked him to take care of Willie, and he replied, Of course you mean in the air, after we get on the ground. Wiley is able to look after himself. Rogers in rare humor. Rogers was a high humor on the trip. At Fairbanks, he joked about the salmon fishing of which the residents boasted. All these boys do is brag about who caught the biggest salmon, Will declared. Last night an oil man brought one weighing 50 pounds to my room and wanted to put it in bed with me. I can't see the use of catching salmon when they crawl out of the water to meet you. The first handshake I got when I stepped ashore was from a big coho. A coho, they tell me, is a king salmon that's on relief. After their stay at Fairbanks, Rogers and Post took to the air to fly the 500-mile stretch to Point Barrow. The weather was none too good when they started out, but Post decided that if they ran into adverse conditions, they would sit down on one of the numerous lakes in the barren, frostbitten country. A radio report from Barrow shortly after their departure indicated they would encounter fog and poor visibility over most of their route. 50 miles out from Fairbanks, the blinding Arctic fog closed in. Ahead of them was the Brooks Range, with its snow-capped peaks. They dared not go on. Post brought the plane down on Harding Lake and waited for the weather to clear. They were impatient to be on the way, and as soon as the visibility lifted, they decided to try it. On the wing again, they chose to poke their way through the fog in order to reach Point Barrow. When they figured they were close to their destination, they came down close to the ground in the hope of finding some landmark that would show them the way. When they saw the Eskimos' camp, Post decided to land and ask the way to Point Barrow. The missing of Point Barrow was no reflection on Post's ability as an aerial navigator. Veteran flyers, who had flown the route numerous times, lost their bearings on several occasions when they encountered fog, and, if anything, it was a tribute to Post's skill that he came within 15 miles of the objective. During the brief stop on the Tundra River, Wiley tinkered with the engine and Will gabbed with the Eskimo, as might be expected. Undoubtedly, from that lone seal hunter, Rogers found material for a jest that he intended to relate sometime, for anywhere he went, he saw something with a humorous twist in it. Even his tech-to-turn flying companion was a fitting subject, and in one of his last pieces of writing, he said of Post, "Wiley is kinder of a Calvin Coolidge on answers. None of them are going to bother you with being too long." After obtaining the direction of Point Barrow, Post sent the plane across the river for a takeoff into the wind, flying speed across the water. What happened? No one knows. Whatever it was beyond the skill of any flyer to overcome, for Willie Post was rated as one of the greatest pilots that ever lived. An airlock in the gasoline feed line, or the sudden freezing of the carburetor due to the failure of the superheater to act properly, have been suggested as the cause. The engine quit, and without sufficient height, it was impossible to bring the ship under control. Arctic flight hazardous. Flying in the Arctic, where such noted pilots as Carl Ben Eielson and Frank Dorbeck perished, is a terrible ordeal at all times, according to flying men who have braved its hazards many times. In the region of Point Barrow, there is ice and snow most of the year, and in the few weeks of summer, there is soft sand to make it difficult to take off and land. Fog and mist arise suddenly to blind the flyer and throw him off his course. And as for storms, the flyers call northern Alaska the breeding ground of cyclones. Joe Croissant, hero of many an Arctic flight, advised the two vacationists to remain at Fairbanks until the weather cleared before hopping off for Point Barrow. But Post and Rogers were long accustomed to flying as a matter of everyday business, and they faced the hazards in the spirit of fun. "If we meet bad weather," said Rogers, "we'll just sit down, open a can of chili, and throw a party until it clears." And so their red ship soared into the midst of Fairbanks and disappeared to the north. Croissant watched them depart, and as a flyer, his thought was of the plane. "There's a ship to go places with," he said. "With that engine, Wiley could lift her out of a frog pond." The thermometer registered 45 degrees at the time of the start, and there were reports of dense fog along the way, but Croissant felt no concern, for he I felt that the plane, as well made and as powerfully engined as it was, in the hands of a flyer like Willie Post, could get through regardless of fog. Before leaving for Point Barrow, Rogers had told friends in Alaska that after going to Siberia, they planned to go to strange places and eventually come back to America by way of Iceland and Greenland. Their long water jump by the indefinite route they had outlined was about 1,000 miles, but Rogers seemed to think little of that. Croissant did not agree with him. He was of the opinion that such a long flight over water was a grave hazard. Off for somewhere. There was something almost prophetic in one of the last articles Rogers wrote before his death. It was entitled, "Off for Somewhere in a Red Bus." Off for somewhere. The words seemed to envision the tragic ending on the tundra. But both men died as they wished. Post, in commenting on his pioneering flights into the stratosphere, once said, "I know it's dangerous, but if I get popped off, that's the way I want to do. Doing the things that I want to do." Once it had been arranged to carry Rogers on a night flight from Dallas to Chicago in a mail plane, he declined to ride in the plane under a waiver when he learned that the plane was not authorized to carry passengers. He chartered a plane and followed the mail plane to Chicago. "We should not break the rules," Rogers commented. "And then, too, I would have had to have ridden on a parachute if I had flown in the mail plane. Picture this farm boy dangling from a parachute. I'll always come in with the plane." In a speech he made in Boston in 1930, Rogers told of the epitaph he wanted placed on his grave. "When I die," he said, "my epitaph, or whatever you call those signs on gravestones, is going to read, 'I joked about every prominent man of my time, but I never met a man I didn't like.' I'm proud of that. I can hardly wait to die so it can be carved. And when you come around to my grave, you'll probably find me sitting there proudly reading it."